Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable, a spin-off podcast of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of filmstage.com. During these episodes, rather than reviewing a film in depth, we'll be tackling a broad range of discussion topics related to the whole of film culture. Who are we? I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, we have the chuckling Amanda Waltz.
Hello, Brian.
And we have the also chuckling Bill Graham.
Yes.
Chuckles all around. Before we begin, I'm sorry, Amanda, what?
I said we're having fun.
We're always having fun. That's why we started this spinoff, because we couldn't get enough of each other. Now, before we begin, we wanted to extend an invitation to everyone out there to let us know what kinds of things you want to hear more about. If there's a particular bit of film news you want to know, or if you want to know our take on, if there's a trend you've noticed, or if there's a cultural sea change in the wind that you think needs more attention, hit us up and we might just talk about it. Reach out, because your engagement is what makes this whole thing work. Speaking of which, the best way to get in touch with us is via our many social media pages. On Twitter, you can find us at @FilmStageShow. You can also catch us on Facebook by searching for The Film Stage Show. And if you really want to lay into us, you can also email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. We also love receiving comments and feedback on iTunes. Go there, give us a comment and a rating, and we will probably read it out loud because that's how much we love them. Fully encourage you to take a minute to search us and let us know what you think. And finally, you can also find the page that these episodes are posted under thefilmstage.com, where you can also comment if you so desire. I am tripping over words left and right, and I apologize. I blame Bill.
Is it the echo?
No, it's just you and your presence.
I have that effect on people.
It is true. You're a crazy man. Anyway, last time we were on, we had a fun time talking about all manner of nonsense and madness. And this week we have more of the same. So let's hop right into it with the first discussion topic. This one was chosen by Amanda, and we're calling it So Seriously Sick of Summer Sequel Season. I'm not your stepping stone. I'm not your stepping stone. That is the Monkees with their seminal hit, I'm Not Your Stepping Stone. Why do we choose that? Because the summer movie season has slowly become a land of sequels. Steps on a path, if you will. From inevitable brands like Captain America to stupefying franchises like Now You See Me. This summer, with few exceptions, these surefire moneymakers are actually taking box office hits hard enough to shake the industry. So why are there so many sequels? And why are so many failing so hard this summer? Amanda, this was your choice. So why
this was my choice.
Your thoughts to kick us off. I know that there are literally tens of think pieces about this all over the internet.
It's tens of?
I was going to say literally hundreds, and I was like, probably not hundreds, but at least tens.
I mean, there wasn't a dearth of pieces about this, I'll admit. Although, none of which could really pin down why they're failing so hard. Because it's not just that they're failing, it's that they are really failing. I mean, it's not just the summer, too, because there were sequels that I had completely forgotten about, like Ride Along 2, Zoolander 2, Woman in Black 2, Allegiant, God's Not Dead 2, which, by the way, only made a third of the first God's Not Dead.
Well, you know, the God's Not Dead franchise really took a hit when Kevin Sorbo couldn't come back because he died in the first one.
Oh, wait, spoiler. Did he? Spoiler.
Oh, come on.
I know. You know, so I've obviously thought a lot about this, and it's not unreasonable for a studio to think that they should produce a sequel for an unsuccessful film, to assume that audiences will embrace it. I mean, and a lot of the films that receive sequels this summer, you know, I would say like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the X-Men franchise, Alice in Wonderland. You know, they all did fairly well. Even Neighbors too. You know, Neighbors, the first Neighbors did well. And it's just odd that, like I said, it's odd that they are failing so disastrously, because you would think, but also, you also wonder, like, who are these movies for? Especially a movie like Now You See Me 2. I mean, none of these...
You are clamoring for another outing by The Horseman.
No.
I'll say that I wrote our review of Now You See Me 2 for the film stage. And I was, like, baffled the whole way through. And it actually holds one of the things that I think is making these sequels almost impossible to, like, deal with.
Well, and it's, I think, with something like, well, you know my theory about Now You See Me 2. It's either an eccentric Russian or Chinese billionaire bankrolling who's obsessed with magicians bankrolling these movies.
Well, they go to Macau, so, I mean, it's possible that it's a Chinese billionaire.
It's the only, but yeah, I think part of it, though, is that it's very obvious that the studios just assume that people are going to go see these movies. And right. I think that that
investment.
Is...
It's the sunk cost fallacy. You're like, well, I saw the first one.
Right. Well, it's also just in the way they promote these movies. There's really not the same amount of promotion given to the first film. And also not the same amount of care given to these films. I mean, when people talk about... when critics talk about Alice Through the Looking Glass, they're just absolutely just flustered as to like why the movie even exists. It's terribly written. It makes absolutely no real effort to connect with the first film. It's just basically a complete mess. So it's just sort of this feeling of, well, if the studios don't care about these films, then why should we? Why should we care about these movies that are just kind of thrown out there with no real effort put behind them? But, you know, it's...
No effort, but a lot of money.
A lot of money. That's the that's crazy. It's so... I mean, because we talk about budgets of films very casually without really thinking about them. But, I mean, Alice Through the Looking Glass was $170 million.
That's insane.
Like, if you really think about that, that is an insane amount of money to throw at anything. That's basically a small country's, not even a small country, like a developing nation's like entire like budget. The GDP, government budget.
Yeah.
Yeah.
GDP is usually what we use for hyperbolic statements like this.
Yeah. GDP. Okay. But yeah. I just think, and I also wonder, can studios even produce original movies anymore?
Well, I mean, this podcast has been, I don't even know if we've talked about that much on the podcast, but we are all shamelessly excited for The Shallows.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons that's true is because we're tired of sequels.
So right.
We tired of sequels. See, yep.
Yeah, we see something that's basically Blake Lively versus Shark from... Yame Colesera, who hasn't made a non-original film yet, mm-hmm. And we get weirdly excited, because even though his films are like Unknown or Run All Night or Nonstop, like, these aren't films that are going to change the face of cinema, but they're like original, and they have right. people that we like, and in situations that are novel and interesting.
Right.
For some stupid reason, I still, every once in a while, shout, I'm not a good man, but I'm not hijacking this plane. I'm trying to save it.
Just don't say that on a plane.
No, I have to be super careful. But like, anytime someone brings my moral character into question, which is often, I scream, I'm not a good man, but I'm not trying to hijack this plane. I'm trying to save it. Which, thinking on it, is an insane thing to do.
That is a very, wow. Whoever wrote that line was committed.
It's a damn good movie. I love Nonstop. I'm going to watch it when this is over. But yeah, it's great. And I think, you know, walking into Now You See Me Too, I was kind of hopeful because I'm like, you know, it's just fucking thief magicians. Like, this could be fun. This could be like lightweight Soderbergh with a little bit of Mamet. But one of the things that I think is happening that's making people hate these movies and not go to see them is that we're not allowed to just enjoy it. They keep trying to build up mythologies and like worlds. And something like Sicario, which we just found out today, is apparently having a trilogy?
Yeah. What? Like, well, guess who else is getting a third movie? Now You See Me.
Well, that it has to, because I don't even know if you remember this from the first movie, but like 40 minutes in...
I never saw the first movie.
Good, Bill. Good.
Yes.
40 minutes
in... Staying strong, bro.
Fight the power, man. 40 minutes in, Morgan Freeman has like a monologue, and he sounds actively dismissive and hateful of this monologue. It's actually kind of brilliant. And he's like...
He turned that in on his phone.
It seems like it. He says, you know, the eye... ancient Egyptian magicians who would use their powers to steal from the rich, like balancing out the inequality, and do the horsemen believe that they're part of this? And it's like, wow, this is the first time I'm hearing about this. Why are you even bringing it up?
Wow.
And, you know, spoilers for the end of Now You See Me, the eye is real, and they are whisked away on a magical carousel. And this movie doubles down and makes the eye like a super important MI6 style thing. And I was just like, why is this happening? This is insanity. You don't need this. Just make them thieves. Stop making them mini Robin Hoods that have to use CG for magic. And it's just like, you know, there's no point. Matt Singer at Screen Crush wrote perhaps the best think piece that I saw on this.
Yeah.
And he penned it. You know, he's like, everything on Earth is being marketed as if it's an event.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
And, you know, when you hear that enough, you start to realize that nothing's an event, except for something like The Shallows, which feels like an event without talking about itself that way.
Can I just say, going back to Now You See Me real quick, one of the most amusing things about the trailers for it, where they have, you know, they have pull quotes and stuff, is like, ooh, it will wow you. As if, like, anything in those movies are real magic tricks.
Yeah.
They're not real magic tricks.
No, like, that's... The Prestige, you could tell that they had done real magic and that. To an extent, obviously. But, Bill, you were going to say
something.
Anyway,
go ahead, Bill.
Well, so this kind of goes back to the 3D whole scenario, why Avatar made 3D so big, and how studios just blindly embraced it as if all of their summer movies and all of their big tentpole films could be an event by using 3D. And it was like,
actually,
no,
do
not
you remember,
everybody.
Bill, that they like would they started post-converting.
Yeah.
And like delaying things like Wrath of the Titans or Clash of the Titans.
Oh, no, they didn't delay that. They just slapped that shit on. That was terrible 3D.
It was really bad.
So Alice is actually one of those first films that really benefited from the 3D conversion, and it made over $1 billion. And I remember a lot of people just kind of looking around. Even now, people are like, how did that movie make that much money? And it kind of reminds me of Minions a little bit, where I'll go ahead and throw my name in the hat. I paid for Minions. I went to go see that. I was part of that billion and a plus, you know, box office. But I didn't realize that it was going to make $1 billion. I didn't realize that many people were going to see that film. And I think part of it is the box office receipts. A lot of us just are not aware, because America, as much as we produce, we don't actually matter box office wise nearly as much as we think we do,
which we just found out with Warcraft.
Now, because that film's definitely getting,
because China's eating this up, everything.
Yeah, China's
crazy. That's why Now You See Me Too went to Macau.
Well, and this is also apparently one of the reasons why they think Pacific Rim 2 is going to exist, and why more than likely they're going to have, you know, probably a Chinese, what do they call it, Jaeger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please call it Jaeger Bomb. Like someone needs
no,
to just...
No, don't.
Just,
please call it Jaeger Bomb.
Jaeger Bomb!
There has to be a point where someone says the words Jaeger Bomb. I mean, it just has to. Now, here's the question. I mean, I went and saw Jurassic World twice.
Right.
I loved it. Oh. I enjoyed the shit out of that movie. And then when it came on HBO, I watched it again. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not immune to this. Like, I get behind some of these things.
Why was that so successful
last year, though?
Why is it falling down now? Let's be really fair. This is something that I've brought up a couple of times. People love watching dinosaurs on the big screen.
That's a flat out period.
That's a very simple, straight to the point.
There is no other franchise. There is no other movie. You can take Peter Jackson's King Kong and maybe extrapolate out.
No, you don't have to take Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Yeah, well, you don't even have to talk about that. But let's be honest. Outside of this franchise, there is not another big budget film that deals with dinosaurs in like a serious manner. Like there's some stupid like what was that 2000 BC and the Jack Black movie where they go back in time and like things like that.
Well, you also have to remember that Jurassic Park had two fairly not super well received sequels before then, and there was enough time between that era to where people were excited again to experience and sort of return to the franchise.
Well,
and I think
here's my follow up looking at that idea is that we have another film that, like Jurassic Park, came out in the 90s, made a lot of money and had a huge cultural impact that's getting an, you know, long later sequel, and that's this year's Independence Day Resurgence.
Oh my God, my husband cannot wait. He is chomping at the bit.
I want to know, do you think that it's going to be as big or even nearly as big as Jurassic World?
It's going to be pretty big. It is. Because there's been enough time. And also, they aren't... I think the other problem with these summer sequels is that they rely so much on brand recognition, which is so strange for some of these sequels because they're not brands. I mean, Now You See Me is not a brand
in the same sense that
X-Men is. But also, it's just forcing this, like you said, Brian, like, you know, these movies aren't events. It's very much like forced franchises where it's like people.
But you would say that something like Jurassic World or Independence Day Resurgence feel like an event because it is a brand. In a way, but it's been so long.
Yeah, and I think people have wanted these sequels in a way that they haven't wanted a lot of like what has come out, and even Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles with, you know, you would think, oh, Bebop and Rocksteady are in it, all the nerds are gonna love this. Nope, did not care.
Well, it's funny because Bill, you said like Jurassic World, people love dinosaurs. Now I love an alien invasion. I also love dog fights. Not dogs fighting, dog fights like planes chasing each other and shooting.
Yep.
And so when I was talking to a friend of mine at work, he said, what do you think of Independence Day Resurgence? And I said, the thing that I loved about Independence Day was the plane versus spaceship aerial dog fight battles. I was like, and I'm super excited to see that because in the trailer, it seems like that's a big part. And I was so intrigued to hear myself say that. Because, you know, it really did have that kind of Howard Hughes-style wonderment to it in the first film, and I didn't realize that was something I'd been missing. So I think, Bill, you hit on a good thing, and, you know, perhaps, Amanda, you also hit on another good thing when we said it's a novelty that we're not getting enough of, and there's also enough time for us to realize that we miss it.
Well, like, let's be honest though, and I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they were talking about how, you know, a lot of these pundits, and I haven't read that many of these specific articles, but I've browsed them, I've read their headlines, and you know, it's like, okay, our audience is tired of sequels, and it's no, not really. Audiences are tired of bad movies more than anything. And if you make a bad original film and then try and make a sequel to it, that, you know, people went in blind and then they saw it and they paid their money and they weren't like, oh, give me a refund because that was shitty. And then it comes up again and there's a number two next to it. More people are not going to be like, oh, yeah.
Hey, but then there's something
shitty. Let me go see it again.
But then there's something like Conjuring 2, and I will say I think horror movies thrive on sequel, cuz Conjuring 2 is doing very well.
And it's Conjuring came in and wrecked shop in the box office department, so it doesn't surprise me, because again, that's quality. And
but I think
horror,
also,
of itself is a fairly novel genre. You know, it's not effects heavy blockbuster summer film.
But here's the thing. So, I mean, let's talk about real-time stats, right? So I got the five-day totals for Conjuring and Conjuring 2.
Oh, yeah.
Five-day. Conjuring 1 is outpacing it by $3 million. So, I mean, as we say, you know, a film like the horror franchise is definitely kind of grounded and rooted in, like, multiples and franchises and things like that. I don't know if it's going to pay out for Conjuring 2.
It's only $3 million. And you got to look at how much they spent.
Oh, yeah. Believe me, the differences in terms of like the original and the sequels with these other films is like insane. That $3 million really is nothing.
But it is a number that may grow over time, because the other factor that you have to realize is a lot of people are kind of tired of James Wan mining the same particular instance.
Right.
And that's one of the things that some horror kind of fanatics have already latched onto and said, hey, like, if you make another one of these, like, choose a different horror story.
Well,
like,
this could be
go ahead and choose.
I will say this could be a topic for another discussion, because guess what? The demonic nun from Conjuring 2.
She's getting a spinoff, yeah.
Getting a spinoff.
She's she's this Conjuring's Annabelle.
Yep.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Well,
anyway.
We haven't solved anything, but God knows we never will.
It's kind of unsolvable in a lot of ways.
The Hollywood machine goes on. But, you know,
hold on. Like, are we looking forward to any sequels? I mean, we've already named
I mean, we did talk about Independence Day.
Yes.
Is that the only one?
Yeah. Yes, Bill.
Yeah,
it's the only one.
Yeah, pretty much. I can't think of any that really intrigue me. Bill, did you have a couple in mind that you wanted to shout out?
No, not really.
I wasn't looking forward to Finding Dory, but that movie's going to clean up.
Oh, yeah. Handily. It'll be fine.
Handily.
I mean, look, come on. I have to get my Jeff Goldblum where I can. I'll definitely go see Independence Day.
Well, you're going to be able to get him in the newest Thor movie, too.
Peak Goldblum.
You know what's crazy? And this will be the last thing that gets said about sequels. I think that one of the reasons that Marvel has insulated themselves is because they've gone so far to the end of the spectrum that we were talking about things that make bad sequels.
Mm-hmm.
They have an output that can't be matched.
Nope.
And they wrap it up so tightly in mythology that you know if you miss one, you're not going to get the other ones. So you will sit through bad ones in order to get the good ones better.
Oh, yeah.
Even if they're not even bad, they're just mild.
They're just meh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, our next topic, this one chosen by Bill.
Woo!
And it is called It's Just Like Netflix, But in a Big Dark Room and You Can't Look at Your Phone.
I can show you. Shimmering, splendid. Tell me, princess, now when did you last let your heart decide? I can open.
That is a whole new world from the seminal Disney hit Aladdin.
We are going to get legally slammed by Disney.
First of all, I don't care. Second of all, we're not really making money off the use of these
songs.
That's
true, we're not.
And I think they fit under fair use because each of them is chosen for a very specific reason.
Yes.
For instance, we're in a whole new world, guys, because we have streaming services like Amazon and Netflix. And as we've seen with the release of Love and Friendship and the upcoming release of The Neon Demon, Amazon is having a moment in the production and distribution side of the film industry. Now, likewise, with Beasts of No Nation last year and their attempted acquisition of The Birth of a Nation this year, Netflix seems hell-bent on doing some distributing of their own.
Oof.
Now, the question that Bill put to us was, what does this entry of streaming services into the studios and theatrical sphere mean for Hollywood? So, Bill, kick us off.
So, one thing that I want to kind of have everybody keep in mind is a lot of times we get numbers about like a production budget, right? And if you've ever listened to like a Q&A with a director or a producer or someone, you know, a studio executive, as soon as you ask them what is the budget of the film, they start to clam up. They get really well, it's projected at blah, 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 blah. And you're like, okay, why the hell don't you have like an actual number? And part of this is kind of the mystique of the Hollywood machine and studios and how they kind of hide their numbers. And to me, it's baffling because most of these companies, I'd say a vast majority of these companies outside of someone like Megan Ellison, they're publicly traded companies, and how these production budgets aren't like nailed down to a T and then box office receipts aren't nailed down to a T is kind of baffling. But so, I mean, it takes a website like Box Office Mojo to basically kind of corral all these numbers and give us some kind of semblance of what we're even talking about. But the big picture here is take that and go ahead and extrapolate it out and think about when the last time you heard viewership of, let's say, a Netflix series, or let's say an Amazon series, or let's say an HBO, you know, show or something like that. You just don't get those numbers. And so these are platforms where they're already guarding their numbers, and you throw them into the Hollywood production machine, and it's maddening. But let's go ahead and run through some numbers. So Chi-Raq right now apparently costs $15 million. Box office, 2.7. Oh. That is not going to work. Now, to be fair, that is $2.7 million theatrically, right? That is not how many people paid for it. That is not how many people streamed it. That is not how many people actually saw the film. But go ahead and try and get those numbers from Amazon. Good luck.
Oh yeah, Netflix is like famously tight-fisted with their viewership.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and talk about something like Love and Friendship, which is Amazon. Okay, so this is distributed theatrically. And basically what Amazon is doing that's a little bit different than Netflix, Netflix is doing day and date release. So they're trying to basically push into the theatrical distribution while simultaneously be on Netflix. And that just pisses all the...
And that's what they did with Beasts of No Nation.
And that just pisses all the theaters off. Right. Nobody wants to have fun with that, because theaters think that the biggest key to them playing a film is exclusivity. And I would argue they're very much right in that front. If I have to choose between paying $7 and sitting next to someone that's potentially going to be on their phone and paying, you know, $20 for chips and soda and drink versus plopping down and paying $5 and potentially inviting a bunch of friends over and watching it in the comfort of my own home, that there's not really a contest there. But let's talk about something like Love and Friendship. $3 million budget, $11 million box office already. So it's already made enough money to justify its own existence. And it's not even 2 weeks into its run. Mm-hmm. And it expanded to 1,000 theaters, what, last week? 2 weeks ago? Mm-hmm. So this film is doing very well, and it can only go up from here, and it still hasn't streamed on Amazon yet.
Right, because one of the reasons that Netflix and Amazon do these things is because they don't get their money from who's watching what. They get it from monthly subscriptions.
Right. Exactly.
So as long as they can say, we've got stuff coming that's not going anywhere else, it's a reason for people to shell out $9 to $11 a month. And that's where the revenue comes from. So you could produce things that no one ever watches, but as long as the idea of exclusive content keeps them coming back, mm-hmm. you're solid, you're golden.
Well, and I think that brings up a very important point, considering that more and more streaming services are becoming available, and you can potentially watch the same movies on each, or more movies than another streaming service. So there's probably more titles available on Netflix than Amazon, but Netflix may have original content that you like better than what's on Amazon. So I think it's more who can produce the best original content now, as opposed to who can stream these, you know, already released movies. But I think that brings up like a whole, and I think like
a
when you look
world.
At, I tried so hard, but if you look at, and I think it's more so, you know, they've been doing this with television for a lot longer. And if you look at the kinds of shows that Amazon is producing, as opposed to the kinds of shows that Netflix is producing, you know, they're obviously trying to get a certain kind of audience. What I find odd is that the difference in movies that Amazon is pursuing as opposed to Netflix. So Amazon, like you mentioned, Bill, you know, they have Love and Friendship, which is this, you know, delightful period comedy based on a Jane Austen novella. They have Neon Demon, which is this, you know, pretty...
yes, please explain Neon Demon.
I haven't seen it yet, so I feel like it's...
See you next week. From the director of Drive and Only God Forgives comes a movie about modeling.
Yes.
Cannot wait.
Well, it's from, you know, it's from a guy who, like, cinephiles are trying to like.
Are trying to like?
He kind of lost it with Only God Forgives.
I liked Only God Forgives.
I have yet to see it, to be fair, but
tied number 10 that year for me, along with Spring Breakers, because I'm crazy.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
but yeah, but if you
both went out for movies at Sundance, because it's not just, you know, making these movies, it's distributing them and being able to say this will be on our thing. And, you know, because we want content creators, as these people see them, to give us these things, we need to give them a theatrical release because that's what people want. So they went to Sundance and got Manchester by the Sea.
Right.
And Netflix tried so hard to get The Birth of a Nation.
Oh, God.
But they couldn't. They couldn't get it. Birth of a Nation went to Fox Searchlight.
Yeah.
Because they don't trust Netflix.
Well, they
saw what Netflix did to Beast of No Nation.
Yeah. Well, and let's back up just a little bit. I mean, if we're being honest, to me, it seems like a lot of these independent films that end up at Sundance, that end up at these various festivals, are actually the better gamble in a way.
Right.
Because it's really
made.
I mean, you can be fairly honest. It is quite hairy to plop down $30, $40, $50 million for a film and have no idea what it's going to look like. Have no idea if they're going to come in on budget. Have no idea if they're going to even make their scheduled release time or anything like that. I can imagine for studio executives as they're watching the days tick by, It must just give them, you know, waking nightmares, I'm sure. And for them, for a studio like Amazon or Netflix to basically watch a film and be like, oh yeah, I dig that, we can definitely make that work, and then be able to just offer money straight up and be like, here's $5 million, here's $10 million. Y'all don't have a hope in the world of distributing this yourself, and you're basically relying on us. And so here's $10 million, take it or leave it.
Right.
And a lot of people are going to be like, okay, you know, what? I mean, I don't have a lot of better options here. And, you know, thankfully, Birth of a Nation actually had some options and had some things to weigh. But from what I understand, Netflix outbid everybody and yet still
got turned down.
Still got turned down.
Yeah.
So it's not just raw money, but it's definitely, I mean, it's smart of them to be able to look at something and just say, okay, this is how I'm going to start getting into this market, is
right.
not through production itself, but through distribution, through mm-hmm. buying it and partnering with someone like, you know, Lionsgate or whoever it may be. And right now it seems like I'm looking at some of these films, you know, something like Cafe Society, it's going to be co-distributed by Lionsgate. And then Manchester by the Sea is co-distributed by Roadside Attractions. And so,
right.
you know, you look at something like Neon Demon. It's got Broad Green Pictures behind it. It's got Scambox Entertainment. I mean, it's like these are films that feel very much like they're almost indie in the way that they're being distributed as well. They're just like a conglomeration of just, all right, how can we make this work? And then they just find out how they can make it work and get it up right. on the screen. And, you know, if you're trying to get it up on the screen for 4 weeks, that's all it really takes. Because the other thing that a lot of people haven't really kind of clued in on, and one thing that I kind of want to bring up, if you know y'all aren't aware or if y'all have forgotten, is when a film is played theatrically, typically it has this the scale where it's weighted towards the studio at first. So the box office receipts, the initial box office receipts for a big film, let's take a Star Wars or something like that, it's usually 70% of the ticket price itself goes straight to the studio. It bypasses the theater 100%. So they only get like 30%, and it ratchets down the further it plays. So it gets more in favor of the theaters the longer it plays, which is great for a big film like, you know, the Titanics, the Avatars, the Star Wars, things that are going to stay in theaters and still draw people. It means suck all when you have a film playing for 4 weeks and then it's immediately on distribution electronically. You know, I mean, you can imagine what that means to a theater, and you
right,
can imagine
popcorn money.
Yeah. And it's like, what is my incentive? Now, I don't know what these kind of distribution deals look like. More than likely, they're going to be weighted a little bit more towards 50-50, or even potentially weighted more towards the theaters themselves, because Netflix, so Amazon is obviously very well aware of the model that you just got to get your product out there. You got to make a name for yourself, and then you can slowly start to reap the benefits. This is something that a lot of big companies have done when they're talking about just raw numbers. They're just trying to make an impact on a market. And this is something that Amazon did with like the Amazon Kindle, where they sold it at a loss, but they just knew if you bought this thing, you were eventually going to buy our content. Mm-hmm. And if you kept buying our content, we were going to just turn around and make money on you anyways. So it didn't matter if we sold it at a loss to begin with. So I think more than likely Amazon, they're probably smart enough to realize let's get in the back door with some of these theater chains. Let's become friends with them. Let's get a conversation going. That way they can just be like, oh, you know, you're going to give us a higher percentage right off the bat. Cool. Yeah, we'll help promote this. We'll help distribute this. We'll help, you know, get the word out for this mm-hmm. film. We'll put it in nice slots. You know, we'll put it at the 7:30. We'll put it at the 9. You know, we may double up screens on it. And
yeah, you couldn't not find Love and Friendship at my local theater, the Art House theater I went to.
Mm.
So, Bill, to wrap us up, do you see this as a good thing or a bad thing? I'm assuming a good thing.
I see this as a thing that we have no idea to figure out what it's going to do, right? I mean, this could – I mean, look, I gave two examples, and I think I misspoke earlier, and I said Shyrock was actually distributed by Netflix. It was definitely distributed by Amazon. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if you're talking about a budget of $15 million and it brings in a total of $2.7 million – theatrically, that's not going to work. But again, these numbers are just complete nonsense because we don't know how much it actually made after theatrical distribution. And it's really troubling, and it's hard for a lot of people like me to really get a firm grasp of whether this is working. You know, let's be honest. The more Neon Demons that we can get out there, the more Love and Friendships, the more Chirax, things like that. I mean, there's nothing bad about having those films out in the marketplace, and especially on a big, you know, even if they weren't theatrically distributed, even if they were just played distributed via Amazon or Netflix, I think that just benefits things. Now, some of these people are going to look at a film that is potentially produced by Amazon and Netflix. And that's really the next big jump, right? It's not just, oh, they bought my film, and, you know, a lot of these actors and a lot of these directors may not have, you know, a whole lot of say in, you know, if Amazon plops down $50 million in front of you, it's hard to be like, oh, that sounds like a terrible idea. Let me go with this $5 million offer, right? But if we're talking about production, how many big name cast members, how many big name directors are going to sign up to be produced by a Netflix, by an Amazon? And so that's the big kind of question that's going to come down the pike, is how many big films that the small studios just aren't making anymore, how many of those films are going to go to Amazon and Netflix, you know? So
that is the question.
And the benefit is rated R, right? I mean, let's be honest. It's true.
Right. You don't have to compromise as much.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is great, especially for Neon Demon. Because like Bill, I'm all for getting as many Neon Demons into this world as possible.
Hell yeah.
I'm going to draw a circle on my lawn and call forth just as many Neon Demons as are willing to show up. Really.
Let's be honest. Is Neon Demon a sequel to Only God Forgives? Yes, indeed it is. I believe
really?
So.
What?
Like spiritual?
Yeah, spiritual. Come on.
Like the
lights. Yeah, come on.
I think it's going to, in every way, feel as though it exists in the same world as Only God Forgives.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm totally down for that. All right, and now it's turn for my topic, which I'm super excited about. And that is, I've had enough, and that says it all. I never thought that anyone could make me feel this way. Now that you're here, boy, all I want is just a chance to say, that, of course, is the hit by JoJo, Get Out, parentheses, leave. Now, why? Why are we talking about that?
Because you love JoJo?
I do love JoJo. There was actually...
She's good.
I like JoJo. Apparently she had a contract thing that meant that she couldn't put out more music and recently was able to get out of that. Anyway, I misspoke. It was actually leave, parentheses, get out, not get out, parentheses, leave. But the reason we're listening to this blast from the past is that this weekend on the Film Stage Show, Bill and Amanda watched a 2.5 hour long horror movie. That
Korean
was,
horror movie.
Yes, to both of their minds, 1 hour too long. Now, this assertion gave me PTSD-style flashbacks to sitting in a theater and enduring the final hours of The Hobbit and Cloud Atlas. movies that I hated and had to continue hating for far longer than I needed to in order to render my opinion. Now, I suffered through these movies because of the common knowledge that it would be folly to judge a film without finishing it. Mm-hmm. But I ask this question, is that true? Is it possible that hating a movie so much that you would break your bonds and walk out of it serves as its own special kind of review? Perhaps not one that you can write about, but on a podcast or, you know, maybe even in the writing, say, this was so awful I couldn't finish it. That's what I want to talk about, because it's a question that has come up now and then. And, you know, as movies get longer and worse, it feels apropos.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you, my experience in The Hobbit, I was like an hour into it and I knew I wasn't on its wavelength. I knew I hated it. By the end, I wanted to, like, gnaw my legs off. It was physically painful to still be sitting there. And one of the things that kept me hanging on was the idea. This happened to my parents. A neighbor told them to watch Fight Club. My parents are not the kind of people that you should have watching Fight Club. They're not movie people. They're not into things like that. And my mother said, I wanted to turn it off, but out of politeness, I made myself watch to the end. And the ending did redeem it slightly. She said that novelty of the twist was worth waiting around for. She still didn't like it, but she didn't hate her friend as much for making her watch it. And that's kind of what I keep waiting for. Like this, like, oh, the final moment of this film might make me hate it less. I did it for The Hobbit. I did it for Cloud Atlas. But, like, it never does. You still hate it.
It's very rare.
And if you're forcing yourself to the end, like, you're not organically enjoying it. You're not sitting through it. You're not making it happen. You're like torturing yourself with the hope of rescue. So what do you guys think? Like, have you ever walked out of a movie?
Yes.
What was it?
Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Okay. All right. Bill?
Walked out?
Yeah,
nothing.
Like you said, screw it. You walked out of the movie.
Nothing.
Nothing?
Really? Wow. Yep. To be fair, the Halloween thing, there was a factor on top of that film being bad, which was there was a bunch of drunk idiots yelling and running around the theater during the film. Oh, but I was like, oh, I'm fine with leaving. I am okay with sacrificing this experience. I would have, I'm trying to think of another one, but yeah, that's the only one I can think of.
Right. I've never walked out of a movie. I've sat through things, you know, I've made myself do it, but my God, like to what end? What was the point? Like just being able to say like, I finished it and it never got better and don't waste your time.
On the subject of The Hobbit,
are we martyrs?
I don't know what to call this part. It was the part where Gandalf and what's Kate Blanchett's character, Galadriel?
Galadriel.
Galadriel.
Sure.
When they're talking about how Saruman. Who's the wizard? Saruman. The wizard is getting fucked up on mushrooms. Do you remember that part?
No. Yep.
It's this really
way, that doesn't happen in the books.
It's this really long conversation where they're consulting each other about what to do about Saruman because he's taken these evil mushrooms and he's doing all these terrible things. I actually was like, I was there with my friend and I said, I'm going to go get something to eat. I went out. I went to the bathroom. I got something to eat. I looked at my phone for a while. I hung out in the lobby. I swear for... for a long time, because I was just like, you know, I'm going to hang out here. There's no way that this scene is going to keep, is going to still be going on when I come back in the theater. And it was. I came back in. Oh, it had been at least 10 minutes.
Well, here's another question. Can you, you know, this is like a micro question within this greater question. Can you judge a movie if you leave for any part of it?
Oh, damn it. Oh, man. I was totally going to make that like a topic in the next couple of weeks. Okay. Okay. Let's go.
Here's the thing.
Hold on. I'm really excited.
Okay, Bill, go ahead.
So
so excited.
I have a couple of opinions of this on this. First off, you got to take care of your business before you get into a movie. Got to be smart. You're a grown ass adult. You understand that this film is going to be 2.5 hours, including previews. Like, let's get real, people. Let's not drink a soda right before. If you're going to drink a soda, drink it, like, pace yourself, drink it maybe an hour into the film, like kind of push it out, keep pushing it out, and then be like, okay, now it's time to eat. Or now it's time to drink, right? So, I mean, typically what I do is usually I come in to a film already fed. Or right. if I'm like most screenings, okay, right?
Bill, all right.
We get it, Bill.
Get to the point. Like, what do you think of either walking out of the movie? Because I would say,
like if you leave in the middle of the movie, you're a crazy person and you are not doing your job right.
That's insanity. Like, yeah. But here's my thing. If I were to leave and say, I hate this film, and then I walked away, I would feel more confident giving people my opinion of that film than if I really liked the film, left for 2 minutes to use the bathroom, and then came back.
Or were really, really confused. Like that's the other thing. Like, can you imagine if you left in the middle of a film, like, let's say, Warcraft.
Triple Nine.
Oh, damn it. Nah.
I wish I could have walked out of Triple Nine.
But see, here's the thing, Amanda. If you had come on to this podcast and told me I hated Triple Nine so much that I left, I would have been like, okay.
Yeah, let's
I would have been
that.
Fine with that. Now, if you had then told me in a parallel reality, I went to go take a phone call during Triple Nine, I missed 10 minutes, and I came back, and I don't like this film, I would tell you to go fuck yourself and watch it again. I think that it is more genuine and honest to just walk out of a film than to render an opinion having missed any amount of time in the center.
Right.
I agree.
All right.
Yeah. I think
that is certainly a valid, it's something that you can basically stake your name on and be like, look, I lasted as long as I could possibly last in this film, and I literally had to give up on it. Now, whether you want
to
take my
review, to finishing it, like, I wish we had an argument of someone who's like, no, that's disingenuous, because like,
It is in a way, though, because there are films that kind of round that corner that end up turning back on themselves and become much better. There
I
are
would
films.
Love an opinion from each of you, like an option, an example.
An example of a movie where
you were like, "Fuck this,
it?
I'm walking out," but then it redeemed itself.
I would say this is kind of a bad example because. Well, I went to see Inherent Vice.
Okay. Uh-huh.
The first 15 minutes of that movie, I had such a resistance to it. Just a visceral, I hate this movie. I want to leave. I cannot believe I have to sit through this. And I calmed myself down. I said, Amanda, it's cool. And I eventually sort of... I ended up loving it. As for a movie where the ending redeemed the rest of the film, that is a tough one. The only example I can think of is, and this is something that a lot of other people have brought up, is The Cobbler. I don't know if that's necessarily, it doesn't redeem it, but it definitely is such an insane, just like conclusion that, people wouldn't stop talking about it. So, yeah, that's the only thing I can really think of. But the rest of the movie was garbage, obviously.
Right.
Well, I mean, let's talk about maybe a film like Mud or something.
I actually
have
not seen Mud yet.
Okay. No. That's a really, really high quality film. Okay. Well, clearly Amanda did not see the last 20 minutes of
it's
that film.
It's fine. I will say the kid actors in that are way better than Matthew McConaughey. I don't know what people are talking about.
Jeff Nichols is great with child actors. Yes. I mean, something like Midnight Special or Take Shelter proves that.
But my example was basically, let's take a film that ends in just like a spectacular display of like like violence, right? Or like a huge like action moment that finally happens, like maybe Godzilla or something like that, where like the final Godzilla. 20-30 minutes of it are like finally they're fighting, finally this is happening, right.
But if a movie can't engage you to stay that long,
right,
I mean, that's a failure in and of itself, right?
It's not, in a way, yes, but in a way not, because a film is supposed to be digested as, now, and you could certainly say this as like a TV series or something like that, but like, let's be honest, a TV series is not hatched up, planned out beat by beat by beat, right, and then produced and then put on the screen. Like there's like, even the best thought out television shows are not like that, but a film is definitely like that. It is shot under the concept of one theme, and then it is projected up on the screen, and it's supposed to take 2 hours, and that
thank
is
you
supposed
for explaining
to be,
what a movie is to us.
I mean, that is what it is supposed.
Well, you know, it's true. It's an unbroken stream of information coming at you, whereas a TV show, you get a break, and every break is an opportunity to say "fuck this, no more."
Right.
I mean, like, I've had people tell me that there are seasons of television that I need to watch. And like, you know, the first 17 episodes are terrible.
Yeah.
And then everything
Doctor.
After that is great. And it's
that
like,
is like,
I can't do that.
That's like with the last season of Arrested Development, when every time I said, I'm going to stop watching this. Oh, give it another episode. Give it to the Tobias episode. No, I'm not. I'm already 3 or 4 episodes in. If it's not good, it's never not going to be good. Like, it's just, I'm sorry, I'm getting on a TV rant. But yeah, but it is, it's kind of, but I think it works the same way, because if you get to, let's say, the middle of a film, for example, I don't know if this counts as walking out. I shut off Francis Ha halfway through.
Oh, I'm down. I'm fine with that. That's another movie I wanted to walk out on.
Like I've stopped watching a lot of films. I've just never, like, walked out of it. Because to me, there is something about my giving up my time driving to a movie theater and basically plopping my ass in the seat and knowing that I'm going to be there for 2.5 hours, 3 hours, whatever it may take. And when you and Brian, you were bringing up something that we can kind of round back up on, but you were bringing up the fact that, like, you miss books, like you miss bookstores, and you miss that physical like contact and like being somewhere and basically picking something and committing to it, right?
This is Bill bringing my Facebook feed into this conversation. But it's true. Yes. You know, and here's the thing.
And that's kind of my thing, is if I'm sitting on my couch, I've got so many fucking options, so many other things that I can do within milliseconds, like literally, like flipping over my phone is a better option than watching this movie, then there's not a lot to keep me from disengaging from a film that is not engaging me to begin with.
Right, because the theater will trap you. You can't do anything else. But at home, I mean, I tried watching with my then fiance, now wife, the movie Comet, I think it's called, with Justin Long.
Mm-hmm.
And Comet. It was terrible. It was a bad movie. And so within 15 minutes, we shut that shit down. It was...
I've had days where I will go through Netflix and I'll start watching a movie. I'll get 5 minutes in and I'm like, nope. And I'll just like go to the next movie and go to the next movie and go to the next movie.
I think it had snowed. Like, we were at home for some reason. And it's like, no, there's everything else we could be doing. Now, the counterpoint to that would be when I said, I have a screener for this documentary called Tickled. And I couldn't not look at the television. Except for the times when I turned to my wife and said, what the fuck is going on? And, like, that's the kind of movie. It doesn't matter if it's in a theater, if it's on home, if it's being projected on the side of a building while I'm walking to work. I cannot look away.
Right.
It's amazing. And I think that in the theater, we kind of say, like, oh, but we have to respect this. But now and every now and then, I'm like, no, this movie isn't respecting me. I need to get that goddamn hell out of here. Cloud Atlas.
It's like you said, you have to... Oh, God, Cloud Atlas. Yeah, that's a whole other discussion. But yeah, that's just like you said, and like, and I've said this before, you know, we have to think about like what we demand of movies of and what movies demand of us. And when a movie is demanding 2.5 to 3.5 hours of our time, that's a big investment. I mean, like, we did Love and Friendship, which was a nice clip, 1.5 hours long, you know, in, you're out. It's great. And just like, why do you need 3.5 hours to tell a story?
I've maintained that if your film is pushing, is either at or pushing close to 2.5 hours, your film has to go beyond just mild entertainment. It has to become great. It has to be something that I could watch again.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, like, in general, like, if you are not above like mild entertainment, fuck you.
Exactly.
You callous bastard.
You are a terrible human being. Quit making movies that are 2.5 hours.
Bless
like,
your heart,
I hate
Bill.
You.
No, here's the thing. Like, other forms of media, we don't, you can render judgment without taking in the whole thing. Even songs, you can be like, first chorus, I'm out.
Right.
Now, obviously.
Yeah. My friend got real pissed at me because what I told her was, I fast forward through songs, like, on first listen. If someone recommends like an album to me, I'll like fast forward and like listen for a couple of seconds, and then fast forward and then listen for a couple of seconds, and I'll be like, nope, don't like that artist.
Wow,
and
we are like, not music people.
And she's like, I hate you so much. You cannot do that. You cannot.
But,
you cannot
no,
say
you
that you listen to that song. And I'm like, no, I listen
but
to
you
it.
You can do that to music. You can do it to books. I know. I know people who are like, ooh, I feel bad if I don't finish a book. I don't have that problem. But I guess it comes up with us particularly because we are critics and we have to render a judgment. And I think that there is some value to a critic saying, I can't finish this. It's just not working.
Well,
like, let's take our site for an example and say,
I don't believe that Jordan would ever let me write a review.
Jordan would not
let
you write a review.
Exactly. No. And so that kind of brings up another point. Like if you're able to maybe make a feature article out of it, right? And then you can be like, well, here's my review of this experience.
Right. You could do an op-ed, but you could not do a review. And I think that's...
And people have done that.
Yeah.
Critics have done that, yeah.
Well, that would be super awkward, though, to be like, I was supposed to write a review. I wrote an op-ed. This movie's a piece of shit.
Right.
There was literally an example... holy shit, was this 2016? Did Zoolander 2 came out?
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, forgot that movie came out.
Yeah. I forgot it came out this year.
Everybody did.
Yeah.
Leonard Maltin actually walked out of that film.
Oh, really?
An hour. And he basically said he wrote an entire piece on IndieWire about why I walked out of Zoolander 2. And his basic like thing was basically, look, I'm paid to do this. This is not worth my time.
Right.
Like I could be watching other films that are worthy of, my time to review them and like post about them.
Now the other side of the spectrum is the angry video game nerd who is preemptively not reviewing Ghostbusters.
Well,
that'll be its own special discussion topic as time goes on. So, yeah, that's where we're at. We would never be able to write a review about it. But I think that it is a fair thing to say, I can't finish this movie. You can't tell someone in the world that it's unfair of them to not finish a movie and render judgment.
Don't finish it. Go on Movie Pooper. Look up the ending. You're good to go. That's what I do.
That's
a
site?
Yeah, it is.
MoviePooper.com?
Yeah.
I use it all the time.
I just use Wikipedia, man.
Yeah, but
no,
you have to
Wikipedia
wait for someone
takes too long.
Really write up this.
Also, right. I don't trust Wikipedia. I trust MovieBoomer.com. I can't believe I just said that.
Wow.
Okay.
Wikipedia just bad. Took a strike in the heart.
Put that on my tombstone. I trust MovieBoomer.com.
Mother of God. All right. Well, that's all for this episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. My God. What a way to end. Let us know what you thought of our crazy thoughts and opinions by finding us on iTunes, reaching out at Twitter, which is at Film Stage Show, or Facebook by searching The Film Stage Show. And, of course, going to thefilmstage.com and commenting on the episode page. Last episode, Marlon Wallace, who we spoke about on a previous review episode, actually wrote down a comment. And he was talking about whether or not we could separate artists from the art they create. And he brought up some of the people who we had recently who died due to problems with drugs, which is something that we did not address when talking about that. And that is something that we will have to address in its own topic, because when we were talking about the other thing, we were talking about people who hurt people, I would say. And while this is still breaking the law, obtaining illegal drugs, you know, my 3-second opinion is you're doing it to yourself. And that's a lot different than beating up Amber Heard. Allegedly.
I agree.
Allegedly beating up Amber Heard.
Dan, we said allegedly.
All right. Now, also, if you have any ideas for topics you want to hear about, write them on a slip of paper and burn it in an old Coke bottle while speaking the true name of God. Or you can just use those previously mentioned methods to contact us. And speaking of contacting us, let's tell the people where you can be found online. Amanda Waltz.
You can find me at MediaWaltz on Twitter, also MediaWaltz on Letterboxd, and also you can find my blog, Steel Cinema, on WordPress.
All right, Bill Graham.
You can find me on Twitter at Duratan #1 fan, also at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on the Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv, and please... Don't steal my Twitter username.
I'm really going to change it to Duratan fan #1.
I'm going to try and claim that.
Go for it, buddy. You do realize that no one's listening live right now, and you will have hours before anyone does.
I'm just
make
putting
that dream
out
come true, Bill.
Bill is just a lazy, lazy man. All right. I can be found on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, same on Letterboxd, same on Instagram, all these places. You can also find my reviews on thefilmstage.com. I have a review of sequels, X-Men Apocalypse, Finding Dory, and Now You See Me Too. So, yeah, go find out my opinions on sequels. And that's all. That is all for today. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Keep an eye on those podcast feeds. We'll be putting out these episodes every other week in addition to our weekly reviews. And we can't wait to speak to you again.
She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained or nothing's lost at such a cost.